He was a little man, shorter than most, with a bald head and thick, reddish-brown beard. His eyebrows were thick and bushy and arched above his dark eyes, giving the impression that he was always astonished or surprised. By physical appearance, Henri Landrieux was not the type of man that one would suspect of being able to romance more than 300 women out of their life savings. But there was something special about this bourgeois second-hand furniture dealer and automobile mechanic that vulnerable women found irresistible. And for 10 of them, their willingness to believe the lies Landrieux told them would cost them more than their meager fortunes. The price they paid for falling under the spell of this 20th century Bluebeard was their life. Born of parents of modest means in 1869, during the middle of France's Third Republic, Landrieux's childhood and early years were as nondescript as he was. His mother was a housewife, and his father was employed as a fireman in the furnaces of Paris's Volcan Ironworks. Young Henri was considered a bright lad who attended Catholic school and was admitted as a subdeacon in the religious order of Saint-Louis-en-Lille. Like many boys of that era, his schooling ended around his 17th year after studying engineering at the prestigious School of Mechanical Engineering. Drafted by the military at 18, Landrieux excelled in the armed forces, reaching the rank of sergeant by the time of his discharge 4 years later. Clearly, by his teen years, Landrieux had recognized that he was brighter than most and was glib with the ladies. In 1891, he seduced his cousin, Mademoiselle Rami, who became pregnant and bore him a daughter. 2 years later, Landrieux married Madame Rami while he was quartermaster of the regiment at Saint-Quentin. Upon their marriage, Landrieux left military life and went into business as a clerk. However, his employer was unscrupulous and absconded with the money Landrieux had given him as a bond, leaving a strong impression on Henri. Incensed with this blow that fate had dealt, Landrieux made a vow to get revenge through a life of crime. Despite his standing as a deacon and member of the choir of his church, Landrieux became a swindler in addition to his legitimate businesses as a furniture dealer and garage owner. His targets were most often the middle-aged widows whom he would meet through the furniture business. Used to following their husband's direction and faced with the prospect of long, lonely, poverty-stricken lives, these women would come to him to sell their possessions. Landrieux would prey on their fears and, in addition to taking their possessions, would woo his victims and entice them to let him invest their meager pensions, which he would promptly steal. The scam worked well for some time, until 1900, when Landrieux made his first appearance in a French courtroom as a criminal. He was sentenced to a 2-year prison term for fraud after trying to withdraw funds from the Comptoir d'Escompte using a fake identity. Upon his arrest, Landrieux attempted, some say pretended to attempt, suicide in jail. He remained married to Madame Rémy, and together they had 4 children. For the next decade, Landrieux was in and out of prison several times. Apparently, the Third Republic had no 3-strikes laws, serving as much as 3 years at a time. Sometime around 1908, he struck upon the scheme that would eventually bring him face to face with the guillotine. In that year, Landrieux, already serving a sentence in a Parisian prison for fraud, was brought to Lille to stand trial for another scam. He had placed a matrimonial advertisement in a newspaper, portraying himself as a well-to-do widower seeking the companionship of a similarly situated widow. In return for some counterfeit deeds, Landrieux persuaded a 40-year-old widow to part with a 15,000-franc dowry. Madame Isaure was left destitute and sought compensation through the courts. She would have to content herself with the knowledge that Landrieux would serve an additional 3 years, for, by the time the gendarmerie caught up with Landrieux, the dowry was gone. He was released shortly before World War I, most likely with the understanding that he would re-enlist in the French army. He had already driven his father to suicide over his lawlessness and left his family penniless and humiliated. Landrieux's mother had died in 1910. He drifted around the countryside, well aware that he had been convicted in absentia for various other offenses, and sentenced to lifelong deportation to New Caledonia. Once the war started, Landrieux, who was still married to but estranged from Rémy, began the scams that led to his downfall. Perhaps it was the war with its heretofore unknown measure of death that turned Landrieux into a murderer. Perhaps it was the years spent in undoubtedly harsh French prisons. Or perhaps it was something else. The Earl of Birkenhead, eminent Oxford don and author of Famous Trials of History, discounts the theory that Landru was driven by bloodlust to kill his female suitors. "There seems to be no evidence of that," he writes in a marvelous 1929 follow-up to Famous Trials. "A man who embarks on this kind of adventure must shake himself free of entanglement. Therefore, it is inevitable that a proportion of the women would be difficult to shake off, and some must have shown no great disposition to hand over their property. The obvious means of overcoming their attachment," Birkenhead surmises, "was to destroy them, and to do so was only too easy. We must therefore postulate that he was callous and inhuman, an assumption which offers no difficulty, seeing that his very mode of life was impossible for any other kind of man." Well-known criminologist Colin Wilson calls Landru a callous ruffian who deserved to be guillotined. The entry in Wilson's Encyclopedia of Murder recounts the savoir-faire that made Landru attractive to his victims. His sense of humor and strong will certainly came out during his detention, interrogation, and at his trial. Perrault's fairy tale about the blue-bearded monster that kills his wives but is done in by a young woman's curiosity is a well-recounted story. Not only does it exist in French literature, but in African, Spanish, and Chinese legend as well. If ever a serial killer resembled a mythic figure, it was Henri Landru as Bluebeard. There is not a lot known about Landru, but it is possible to develop a simple profile of this modern Bluebeard by his actions. His victims, both the living and the dead, were among the most vulnerable members of society, so he was clearly without conscience. Few serial murderers are ever stricken by remorse or guilt for their actions, except to say that they are sorry to have been captured. There were so many victims of his confidence schemes, the contemporary estimates numbered about 300, that he was clearly greedy. He was probably a romantic man, able to sweep lonely women off their feet, and since his physical appearance was more comical than handsome, he must have been a smooth, fast talker. His sexual appetite, reportedly, was ravenous. Landru was intelligent and silver-tongued, not only with the ladies, but also with his fellow soldiers and other men. All the while he was taking advantage of women, Landru was also defrauding weary, recently discharged soldiers of their pensions. Landru was not a simple psychopath like other serial murderers. He had a sense of right and wrong, but he did not apply the same rules to himself. He justified conning one soldier out of his detachment pay because the man had a mistress, despite the fact that Landru also had a mistress and was cheating on her as well as on his wife. He showed a sense of remorse over some of his actions, not his homicides, expressing embarrassment in court that his wife, the long-suffering Remy, would find out that he had been cheating on her because of certain testimony. Putting a label on Henri Landru is difficult because he did not really fit into a specific crime classification. At best, he can be called a multiple murderer rather than a serial or spree killer. He cannot really be considered a serial killer because serial killers are currently defined as persons who kill two or more victims in different locales and in either an organized or disorganized fashion with some sort of cooling-off period between the killings. The killings are often the culmination of a buildup of anger or lust, and the murderer finds a sense of release after the slaying. They have a great deal of control over their victim selection and the time of the crimes, and their identities are not usually known until the time of the arrest. Landru meets some of these criteria, but the time gaps between slayings were caused by his need to get close to his victims to obtain a financial reward. If sex or anger was at the root of his murderous need, Landru could easily have killed his victims shortly after getting to know them, or, better yet, his selection of victims would have been more random. Spree murderers, on the other hand, are killers whose crimes take place in different locales, in a disorganized fashion, but within a fairly short period of time. Often, spree killers are not in control of victim selection or the time of the killing. They are usually on the run from at least the first offense, and often before. Law enforcement agencies often know the identity of a spree killer before the arrest. Henri Landru was in control of his victim selection and in the time of their deaths. He was not pressured into a hurry-up situation by law enforcement pursuit and never appeared to be on the lam despite his conviction in absentia. Landru killed for money or to rid himself of a tiresome or inconvenient lover. His killing method is unknown, but evidence at his villa suggests that the slayings were most likely clean and that the victims were probably not defiled in any way. It is possible that Landru killed during a sex act, but no evidence suggests that this was the case. Lust was not his primary motive, and he is distinctive among multiple murderers because anger, revenge, or sexual release were at best secondary motivators. Most killers for financial gain do not destroy the evidence of their victims' deaths. In insurance or inheritance scams, proof of death is often required. Few killers want to wait a decade or so to collect their ill-gotten reward. But Landru obviously took great pains to cover up his crimes. He sought to avoid detection and make it look like his victims were still alive. In effect, Landru created a different classification of multiple killer. He was the male version of a black widow spider, one that takes what it needs and then kills its mate without remorse. Henri Landru combined the worst characteristics of the most terrible type of criminal. In 1914, the following advertisement appeared in the Paris newspapers. Widower with two children, aged 43, with a comfortable income, serious and moving in good society, desires to meet widow with a view to matrimony. For a French widow, faced with a life of loneliness and penury in the depressed economy of wartime France, such an advertisement must have seemed as heaven sent. Landru, who placed the ad, had no trouble meeting women. The first woman to meet this 20th century Bluebeard was Madame Couchet, a 39-year-old woman with a 16-year-old son, André. Couchet worked in a lingerie shop in Paris and was barely keeping her head above water when she made Landru's acquaintance. He told her his name was Monsieur Dial and that he was an engineer. Their relationship flourished over time, but was not without its ups and downs. Landru's scheme was almost revealed before it had a chance to flower after Couchet and Dial had a falling out. Couchet begged her family and brother-in-law to accompany her to Diard's villa near Chantilly with the hopes of ironing out their differences. Landru was not in when they arrived, but the family apparently felt enough at home to search the villa. Her brother-in-law found a chest filled with many letters from other women and informed Couchet that her lover was a fraud. She chose to disregard her family's advice to dump the imposter and instead furnished a villa at Verlunier, outside Paris, and became estranged from her family. Dial, Couchet, and her son moved to the villa. The last time Couchet and André were seen alive was in January 1915. Shortly after the three moved to Verlunier, Landru opened a bank account with 5,000 francs, which he claimed was part of his father's inheritance. In all likelihood, the money came from Couchet. Soon after Couchet's disappearance, Landru's wife was presented with Couchet's watch as a present. His next victim was an Argentine named Madame Labordeline, the widow of a hotelier. She had told friends that she was planning to marry a charming engineer from Brazil, but frustrated with the red tape, the pair decide to dispense with the ceremony and move in together. Afterward, a man that her former neighbors identified as Landru returned and collected her furniture, sending some to his villa and the rest to a garage in Neuilly. Labordeline was last seen in July 1915 when she had arrived at the villa with her two dogs. Madame Guyen, a 51-year-old widow whose full name was Marie-Angélique Désirée Pelletier, was last seen at the villa a month later. Also in 1915, a Madame Ayon visited Verlunier and disappeared. Whether or not there were others between the murders of Ayon and 19-year-old André Babelet, a servant girl who disappeared in March 1917 en route to visiting her mother, only history knows. And why Babelet was slain is also a mystery. She was as poor as a church mouse and had nothing to give Landru but her charms. Did she, like Fatima in Bluebeard's legend, stumble across Landru's secret? Or was she killed merely because he could not rid himself of her? Regardless, poor Babelet followed the fate of Landru's other victims and was never seen alive again after meeting up with Landru. After Babelet disappeared, Landru, apparently busy with other scams like his detached soldier scam and a petrol fraud, left Verlunier for a new villa in Gambé and promptly had a large cast-iron oven installed. He laid low for almost 2 years, but soon returned to his murderous ways. Landru courted Madame Buisson, a wealthy widow, for nearly a year before he succeeded in creating an estrangement from her family. She moved with him to Gambay without her son, who went to live with his aunt. In April 1917, Buisson was seen for the last time. His next victim at Gambay was Madame Louise Léopold Jaume, who disappeared in September 1917. Landru's new neighbors in Gambay noticed black, noxious smoke pouring from his villa after her disappearance. Annette Pascal, 38, followed Jaume by vanishing in the spring of 1918. Finally, Marie-Thérèse Marchadier, an entertainer known among the non-commissioned officers of the French army as La Belle Mythèse, and who had retired to relative anonymity in Paris, was visited by Landru, who wanted to purchase her furniture. A friendship blossomed, and she accompanied the murderer to Gambay in late 1918 and promptly disappeared. In all, at least 10 women and one boy, and two dogs, had disappeared after meeting Landru, yet no police had ever suspected him of any misdeeds. It would take a pair of anxious families to bring Bluebeard at long last to justice. Landru had taken great pains to separate his victims from their families, but after their deaths, he took equally strong measures to assure the families that their loved ones were alive and well. Two of Guyen's friends received postcards from Landru, saying that Guyen was unable to write herself. He forged a letter from Buisson to her dressmaker and another to the concierge of her Paris apartment. Landru represented himself as the attorney of Madame Jaume, who was divorcing her husband and successfully closed out her bank accounts. 2 years after Buisson met Landru, her son, who was living with her sister, passed away. Obviously, the family wanted to notify Madame Buisson, but was unable to find her. Her sister remembered that Buisson had whispered her intention of running away to Gambay with a Monsieur Guyet. She wrote to the mayor of Gambay, seeking help in locating either Buisson or Guyet. The mayor replied that he knew neither of them, but perhaps she should meet the family of Madame Colombe, who was also missing at Gambay. She had vanished under similar circumstances. Unbeknownst to anyone, Colombe had disappeared after meeting Landru in early 1917. The tenant of the villa in question, the mayor told the family of Buisson, was not Monsieur Frémier, the fiancé of Buisson, but Monsieur Dupont. However, when the police went to Villa Hermitage, as Landru's estate was known, they could not find Frémier, Dupont, Diard, the name given to Colombe's family, or Landru. The villa was unoccupied, but recently lived in. Mademoiselle Lacoste, Buisson's sister, was not discouraged. She had seen Frémier, so she began combing the streets of Paris near Frémier's old residence, looking for him. In 1919, her search paid off. She spotted Landru coming out of a dry goods shop and followed him, only to lose him in the crowd. She returned to the store and found out that the man's name was not Frémier, but Guyet, and that he lived in the Rue de Rochechouart with his mistress. Immediately, the police were summoned and Landru was arrested. But on what charge should he be held, the gendarmerie wondered. Clearly, murder was suspected, but where was the body? There was no evidence that Landru had killed anyone, and the strong-willed Bluebeard was unwilling to discuss anything with authorities. They returned to Gambay, where a thorough search was undertaken. The gardens were excavated looking for bones, but the only remains police found were those of a pair of dogs. They searched his old villa at Verunet and came up equally empty. All the police had to go on was a cryptic memorandum book where Landru had meticulously recorded his income and expenses. But within the copious notes were several names that interested authorities. On one page was the entry, A. Couchet, G. Couchet, Brésil, Crozatier, Havre, Count Buisson, A. Colombe, André Babelet, M. Louis Jaume, A. Pascal, Monsieur Mercadier. Buisson and Colombe were missing, and the authorities soon learned that the whereabouts of the Couchets were also in question. They suspected that this was a list of victims, but again, they had no bodies. confident in the erroneous knowledge that he could not be convicted of murder without a body. Such a conviction is possible under French law. Landru kept silent and refused to talk with the police. For 2 years, authorities investigated the disappearances of his victims, yet Landru never admitted anything. Slowly, they learned that each of the women in the ledger had met Landru through his marriage advertisements and had disappeared. Interestingly, Landru had recorded the purchase of one-way tickets from Paris to Gambé for each of his victims, while marking round-trip tickets for himself. The gardens in Gambé and Verrugnier were dug up time and time again. Authorities tried to link Landru to purchases of acids and other chemicals to no avail. Finally, neighbors at Gambé told authorities of the noxious fumes that often emanated from the kitchen. The stove that Landru had installed shortly after his arrival in Gambé was inspected, and the horrific evidence of murder was uncovered. In the ashes, police found small bones, undoubtedly human, as well as burned but still recognizable fasteners of the kind worn on the clothes of French women. Landru had disposed of his victims by burning their remains. How they were killed was still a mystery, but what had happened to Madame Colombe and Madame Buisson, as well as 9 others, was clear. 2 years after his arrest, Landru was charged with 11 counts of murder and set for trial. There is little doubt that Landru's trial captivated his countrymen. Consider the time it occurred. He was arrested in April 1919 at his home in Paris with his mistress, 27-year-old Fernand Segre, whom he had picked up in an autobus in the city. France was still recovering from the bloodiest war in the history of civilization, and the peace talks at Versailles were not going well for them. Shortages and economic depression abounded, and a case that promised sex, gossip, and gruesome killing was delightfully played up by the papers as a diversion from the dreary day-to-day life of post-war France. Also, take into account that in 1919, there was no such term as serial killer. Although multiple murder wasn't unknown in Europe, it was still a novelty, unlike the present day, where the concept of a serial killer is as ubiquitous as a pickpocket was in the 19th century. The murders committed by Jack the Ripper across the English Channel were just 40 years prior, and a human monster who could kill so many without remorse was still an aberrance to the French and English alike. The idea that a Frenchman, a Parisian no less, could be capable of such atrocities profoundly impacted the society. Landru's trial began in November 1921 and lasted nearly a month. The French system of justice had been instituted in 1848, and while not, as it is commonly believed, assuming the guilt of the accused until innocent is proven, it is heavily weighted against the person on trial. Not only does the chief judge in the 3-judge panel serve as an interrogator, the French allow questioning of the accused for the sake of investigation in front of the jury during the trial. The French system also allows the victim's relatives to bring suit for damages during the trial, and the victim's legal counsel can question the accused and argue before the jury. Clinging to his mistaken belief that he could not be convicted without evidence of a body, Landru's defense was essentially to stonewall the court. Time after time, he would refuse to answer questions and reply that it was no one else's business what he knew of their disappearances. He also believed that because he had been judged sane enough to stand trial, his innocence was assured. "In acknowledging I am sane, they are thus establishing my innocence," he told the media, which covered the trial with an enthusiasm unmatched for the time. For days, he stood before withering interrogation by the court without changing his story. "I have nothing to say," he said over and over, much to the frustration of observers. Every time new evidence was unearthed, Landru merely shrugged his shoulders and denied everything or refused to discuss it. "What of your relationship with Madame Guyen?" he was asked in open court. "I am a gallant man and will say nothing," Landru replied to the exasperated magistrate. "I cannot think of revealing the nature of my relations with Madame Guyen without the lady's permission." During the trial, Landru's health began to fail. He started to provide statements of fact in response to questions, but the prosecution quickly refuted his allegations. "His strategy was a tactical blunder," wrote Lord Birkenhead. "Where explanations are obviously needed," he wrote, Unless an unfavorable inference is to be drawn, the failure to afford these explanations will tend to confirm the inference. Landru's impotence before the court clearly grated on the jury. His evasions and quickness to answer with sarcasm only succeeded in proving that he was the kind of man who would deceive women like his victims. It took the jury just 2 hours, after nearly 25 days of testimony, to decide Landru had killed the 11 women. The penalty for such a crime was death. French justice is swift. Just 2 months passed from the time of his conviction until Landru received word that his execution was imminent. Unlike American justice, where a prisoner is well aware of his or her execution date, the French system does not inform the condemned until shortly before the execution. The guillotine is a curious method of execution, and although it is generally held to be humane, there is some question about how quickly one dies after being decapitated. Two doctors in the 1960s wrote that death is not instantaneous. Every vital element survives decapitation. It is savage vivisection followed by premature burial. Doctors Piedlievre and Fournier go on to discuss how the brain is capable of breaking down complex sugars in the neurons into oxygen for as long as 6 minutes after decapitation. Eyewitness accounts also call into question the swiftness of the onset of death after beheading. Did it, those who saw the grimacing heads in the basket wondered, kill instantaneously? Writes Colin Wilson. In the 1790s, this question was much debated, as when Charlotte Corday's head was held up and slapped by the assistant executioner. Men swore that it not only blushed, but showed most unequivocal signs of indignation. In an even more graphic account written in 1905, a French doctor experimented with the head of an executed criminal. The head fell on the severed surface of the neck. I was not obliged even to touch it in order to set it upright. Chance served me well for the observation, which I wish to make. Here, then, is what I was able to note immediately after decapitation. The eyelids and lips of the guillotined man worked in irregularly rhythmic contractions for about 5 or 6 seconds. This phenomenon has been remarked by all those finding themselves in the same conditions as myself for observing what happens after the neck severing. I waited for several seconds. The spasmodic movements ceased. The face relaxed, the lids half closed on the eyeballs, leaving only the white of the conjunctiva visible. It was then that I called in a strong, sharp voice, "Langui!" I saw the eyelids slowly lift, without any spasmodic contractions. I insist advisedly on this peculiarity. But with an even movement, quite distinct and normal, such as happens in everyday life, with people awakened or torn from their thoughts. Next, Langui's eyes were definitely fixing themselves on mine, and the pupils focused themselves. Then, I was not dealing with a sort of vague, dull look without any expression that can be observed any day in dying people to whom one speaks. I was dealing with undeniably living eyes that were looking at me. After several seconds, the eyelids closed again, slowly and evenly, and the head took on the same appearance as it had before I called out. It was at that point that I called out again and, once more, without any spasm, slowly the eyelids lifted and undeniably living eyes fixed themselves on mine with perhaps even more penetration than the first time. There was a further closing of the eyelids, but now less complete. I attempted the effect of a third call. There was one further movement, and the eyes took on the glazed look which they have in the dead. I have just recounted to you with rigorous exactness what I was able to observe. The whole thing had lasted 25 to 30 seconds. Regardless, in February 1922, Landru was brought before the guillotine. Landru bade farewell to his attorneys and presented them with some artwork he had drawn while in prison. Had they looked inside the frame, his attorneys would have found a written confession from Landru admitting his crimes and how he disposed of the bodies, but this was not discovered until nearly 5 decades later. He declined to hear a mass and rejected the traditional glass of brandy from his jailer. Landru indignantly refused to make a statement, saying the very question was an insult. Landru stood before the guillotine which had been the preferred form of execution in France since its revolution a little over a century before. He knelt, and within moments, the blade had fallen, and one of the coldest mass murderers of all time died without ever expressing remorse for his crimes.